Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with episode 388 and part one of my conversation with one of the founders of both Black Earth Percussion Group and the Percussion Group Cincinnati, now a retired member of the faculty at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and current performing percussionist, most notably for the Innocence Project, Alan Oddie. We'll get back to him shortly. And we're back. I hope you've all had a great couple of weeks. Mizzou is currently in its spring break, which is likely later than all of the other college spring breaks for reasons I'm still not totally sure of. And during the previous week, Marching Mizzou, for the first time since I've been working with the group, got the chance to march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Dublin, Ireland. This was a trip we were originally supposed to go to in 2020, but it was canceled 4 days before we were going to leave because of COVID. We were hoping we were just delayed and would get to go in March 2021, but international travel was still very dicey at that point, so that version of the trip was completely off. Fortunately, we got picked to go this year, and it actually happened. I will conclude this episode of the podcast discussing more about the trip. The schedule and pace of that experience was so packed that I ended up delaying the podcast for the week. So we're back. And now let's get to our conversation with Alan Oddie. I've definitely known of Alan for a while and have seen him perform quite often at PASIC with Percussion Group Cincinnati, but I'd never gotten the chance to meet him. I've had a number of students who studied with him at some point at CCM on the show, including John Lane, Olivia Kiefer, and Alex Fragiscatos, among others, and all of them have suggested having Alan on. I'm glad he was up for it. Alan's career is pretty extensive and active, and continues that way. He's best known for his chamber work with Percussion Group Cincinnati and Black Earth, and continues in that vein, working with both an early music improvisational group in Cincinnati, along with the Innocence Project that he's been performing with for many years with John Lane. We talk a bunch about the Innocence Project with John when he was on in 2023. I would definitely check that episode out if you haven't heard it yet. And Alan will present his side of the story there as well. Alan's life and career have been so full that we ended up going long on this and recording two separate sessions to get a full picture of Alan's work. So today on part one, we'll get to what Alan's doing now, growing up in Wisconsin, his time as a student at Oberlin, his years with Black Earth Percussion Group, and his arrival at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music and the formation of the Percussion Group Cincinnati. Next week in part two, we'll focus mostly on his time as a faculty member at CCM and have the usual close to our show at that point. So let's get to part one. We recorded this portion of the interview over Zoom on February 28th, 2024. And it begins right now.
Alan, give me a summation of your percussion activities as they are right now.
I'm glad you didn't ask for the last half century.
Sure, yeah, yeah. We'll get to that. That'll come up.
Right now, there are maybe there are a couple of things which take my time and great interest. the most surprising will be that I met some women in Cleveland, and now the story gets a little bit longer. But I was at a summer residency thing in New Hampshire for ensembles, and I was there for a week with two former students who were doctoral students. One is a woman who is a violinist, who is Anthony Braxton's, first call violinist. She tours the world doing crazy improvisation and wonderful things with Anthony Braxton, has all these great guitar pedals and all of that. And then another guy who's a composer and builds his own Euro rack kind of, you know, it's all electronic stuff. Okay. So while they were here, I began playing with the two of them in just a free improvisation ensemble and a trio where I could begin to, you know, that's something I had never done in my life, is just improvisation. And here were two younger people who were very comfortable with this. I actually asked them, you know, could they, both of them had been in different classes or seminars of mine. And I asked them, hey, could I play along with what you guys are doing sometime? And they were very, very happy that I was interested. Anyway, so I've been building little instruments, you know, with contact mics and experimenting and all of this. So that's what I do with Paul and Erica as Vaster Than Empires. And, you know, we have a few gigs a year in strange clubs and stuff like that. One of the things we did, so we were together for a week in New Hampshire at a place where you can apply to be there for a week or two to just work as an ensemble. So we were doing that, our, you know, crazy free improvisation electronic music. And in the next studio over were these three lovely women from Cleveland on a project of Hildegard.
Wow.
And they were, and, you know, I was fascinated. I've always, you know, loved early music, but never had a real entry into it. So I paid lots of attention during that week. And when the week was over, I wrote to them and I said, you know, I'm in Cincinnati, you're in Cleveland. If there's any chances, I am very interested to pursue this kind of early music thing. And the interesting response was they all have doctorates in early music. And they said, no percussionist comes into a special program to get a doctorate in early music. You know, so often we know we wish we had someone, but the people aren't generally not at hand. So they were very happy to have the opportunity. So for that was in 18, so however long ago, that was 6 years already. I travel regularly to Cleveland to do, you know, weeks. They send me little recordings on their phones or whatever, we get on the same page. And what's wonderful about it is that after a half century of being, you know, one of being in percussion groups, mm-hmm. where everybody in the group had an opinion about what I was doing and how I was doing it. You know, that was great. I mean, it was a lifelong drum lesson. But suddenly I'm the only one, you know, in the group. I'm just, you know, kind of the timekeeper. And the whole early music thing is, you know, it's as creative as the newest music. So they hand me music that looks like it should be a piece of artwork on the wall, you know, and tell me what it means, how to do it, sing it for me. And then, you know, and I do some research and come up with some sorts of things to do. And they're wonderful. You know, they're as gifted as any musicians I've ever worked with. It's awesome to do these things with them. And, you know, if they, I'll play something, you know, go up for rehearsals and they'll say, I don't know what, but not that.
Mm-hmm. Is it usually paradiddles? Is that why?
No, it's this, you know, it's the instrument that I've chosen.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Somehow not the right sound. And the other thing that I've learned about this, you know, making contact with a few other people in this country and in Spain who do this sort of music, percussionists, is that one shouldn't be intimidated about how accomplished your Middle Eastern groove chops are, because what we come to realize is that all these people who want to do especially Iberian Peninsula medieval music, if they need a percussionist, the only thing they can do is go to the people who are, you know, the expert doombag players and brick players and who are just, you know, virtuosos at this kind of stuff. It's not that you need to be a virtuoso at Levantine sort of groove things in order to play medieval music. It's just that we hear that a lot because there's nobody else doing it. So, I mean, of course, I'm learning and you know, trying to be better. But I found that actually an important point to come to realize about this. So that's one thing I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Trobar Medieval. Tremendously satisfying. Even, you know, I had a dulcimer, but then I found an Iranian santur, which they like better. The ladies like it better. It's more, you know, for doing Arabic influence kind of music. So I'm learning a little bit of dulcimer kind of playing to, you know, anyway. This is fair. I mean to be encouraging on this topic. It's tremendously fun and tremendously creative. And so that's one thing. I guess that's two things, because I met them through the improv group. And the thing that I do most is with my colleague, former doctoral student John Lane, which is this performing social justice arts advocacy kind of thing, which was a very natural place for me to want to get to spend more time in that. But we have a very specific piece called, you know, The Innocence, this one piece. I think you've talked to John a little bit about it.
Yeah.
We have tours, one-offs and little tours throughout every year. So on the one hand, I'm annoyed to have to sit at the computer and still, after all of these years, be typing those emails, you know, hey, we've got something really cool. Could you buy us for, you know? my younger colleague, John, does more of that than I do. So, but anyway, that's a very active and tremendously satisfying activity these days. I still have this piece. Frederick Gajewski wrote this big solo piece for me back in 2007. Frederick is someone I've known for my whole adult life. So The Fall of the Empire is this set of pieces for a speaking percussionist. And I just had a solo recital a couple of weeks ago where I did that again, and a couple of other things on a series in a church here in Cincinnati. Turns out that was also a good place to do it. You know, it's like people who come and are sort of curious and interested. The fantasy about being able to retire from CCM while, in my own opinion, I was still playing well enough to be able to do things, mm-hmm. and that I would know enough people around the country that I could make connections and still do things, has actually turned out to work. I loved teaching. I loved the students. After all of that time, nobody was bothering me about anything. Just kind of do what I wanted, and nobody wanted me on any kind of faculty committees.
Oh, well done.
I know. Well, here's how you do it. You just have very strong opinions. When you're on those committees, let them know that you have darn strong opinions. And then, oh, we don't want that guy.
Get him.
So anyway, the only reason that I thought I should maybe stop doing that after 40 years was in the hopes that there would be more time to do all these things that I have been able to do. So I'm recommending that to people as well. Retirement is a good idea. I recommend to you.
I can't do that just yet, but thank you. I take it into consideration. On the Innocence Project, I asked for a John's kind of version, but I'm curious about how you came to that project, how John is a part of that project, what led you all to start doing that?
Both Frederick Gajewski and Herbert Brunn were tremendously influential figures in my life from the first days of Black Earth. And these are two opposite sides of that same coin of an intense paying attention to the musician in society. And whereas Herbert and his computer graphics and all of these things is an old world, totally intimidating philosopher, writer, philosopher of very, very high level intellect, and Frederick is, was out there on the streets, shouting Marxist slogans and writing people, people united, kind of pieces. But they were, they were friends, of course, two kind of Europeans. I came to realize that the whole history of the shorter history of Black Earth and the long history of Percussion Group Cincinnati, ultimately to play the chamber music we wanted to play at the level we wanted to play it, to be taken seriously on the string quartet level of what we cared about, we had to make careful programs of good music that could be bought could be supported on the university series, but also on chamber music series and the like. So my own proclivity towards paying attention to how music might interface with social issues, how serious music. I mean, we know how Pete Seeger and Peter, Paul, and Mary did it, but how do you do it if you're in classical music? Well, I mean, this had to, I had to take a little bit of a back seat for all of those years. What happened, I come to answer your question now, was that John was here as a doctoral student. And I guess in 2006, there was an exhibit, an art exhibit at the Contemporary Arts Center downtown, of these fabulous, huge wall-sized photographs on this subject of wrongful incarceration, a book about it, little films about it, interviews. The Arts Center called the conservatory and said, for the opening of the show, we would like some sort of, event. We're making an event. Anybody there who could do something, sort of provocative? Yes, call Adi. He's in the basement. He could do something.
Call Adi in the basement.
And John, John was right there right then. And I said, this would be an interesting, we should do this together. Why don't I involve you? Would be a good project for you at this point in your life. So that's how we started on it immediately together. We, neither of us had ever even heard of this issue of wrongful imprisonment. we went down and saw the show before it opened, listened to all of these things, were overwhelmed by the show, by the issue, by our introduction into this world. Had a little bit of time to share some ideas about how to respond with a 10 minutes of sound and activity. But that was our introduction to it, with no thoughts at that point of that it might be anything else. I think by the time of one of his doctoral recitals, we had expanded it to maybe 12 or 15 minutes and played it together on one of his doctoral recitals. So that's how it all began.
As it's developed, what has the repertoire for what you two play expanded, changed? Is the show, if I were to see the show now, would it be kind of something more or less set in stone, or do you all still pick at it and try to figure out how to make it kind of move it to the next step, I guess?
Set in stone is good, because the central piece of this hour is us smashing rocks along with historic chain gang recordings. I would say it's been some years that it's pretty much, well, maybe since I retired. So around 2017, which then gave me complete freedom to be out and about and put more energy into these things. Since then, we made it, it had been growing all along, and it had gotten to the point where we could offer it as half of a program, and either he and I would do something else on the other half, or we would partner with somebody else with some sociopolitical, you know, social consciousness issue. We decided, okay, let's do this, make it into an hour. So we just offer the two of us doing just this. And that's been now at least six years or so that we pretty much codified it as that. Though, interesting that you ask just now, because last week we were in Michigan and did the premiere of one new piece. We have the show, if we call it that, you know, it's a performance art piece in 18 tableaus. It was 17 tableaus. In a couple of weeks, we're going to an art gallery in Washington, D.C., where there's a show of carceral art. So not necessarily or probably not wrongfully convicted people, but just art made by people imprisoned. But somebody in Washington, we had played in D.C. a year ago, somebody saw that show, told the gallery, hey, get in touch with these guys, they could do something nice for your show. They did, and the gallery said, there's one artist here, not an incarcerated person, but an artist who's been working on this subject and has a whole pile of pieces of jail bars from destroyed jail cells. And this pile of jail bars sort of travels as an installation in different shows on this subject. Do you think you guys could somehow use these things to make a piece? Well, of course, because our whole piece is it's all found objects. That was from the very beginning. We're not going to do a program about wrongful imprisonment, which impacts a certain strata of society. Poverty and homelessness and all such things are all intricately connected here. We're not going to be playing $20,000 marimbas and $1,000 snare drums. You know, the whole show is rocks and boxes, cardboard boxes and books and all such stuff. So we, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we added one piece with these prison bars. It was so great that they got us to do this. It's a great addition to the evening. I asked a poet friend of mine if he would think about, you know, some little text. Most of the text we have made ourselves or found in, you know, it's more didactic stuff, which we somehow have to turn into performance art poetry. So it's interesting to listen to. But in this case, I asked a friend and he wrote a little thing and just said, you know, use it however you want, however you can. So anybody who would see it can expect to see the same thing. It's basically a codified piece.
Now, what are the ways that you, with that piece, you've connected with some of the formerly incarcerated?
Through every state, most states have their own chapter of this Innocence Project, which is lawyers who are doing volunteer time, and it's usually located in a law school in some university where law students are also taking courses, and part of their coursework will be to be going through these file cabinets of applications and all such stuff. And it turns out that some states have very high-functioning such projects, and some states are just barely stumbling along, can barely keep up with what they're trying to do. And John and I are fully aware that, you know, they have to do, we want them to be doing that work of reading the files and helping who they can help in the way they can help. If we get connected to some sort of performance possibility, we try to be in touch with these people and say, you know, if you want to come and just put out your materials or come and have a question and answer after the performance, or we will sit on panels during the day, And that's how we've met a number of formerly of exonerated people, who are, of course, incredibly special people, because to have gone through this process and then come out of it not a completely damaged human being. I think most of them must come out just really in pretty difficult circumstances. But the few of them that somehow find it in their being to forgive and to want to, most of them then become involved as spokespeople for these state chapters. So those are the ones we meet and I've traveled with even. And the obvious question is, you know, really two privileged white guys doing this? I mean, this comes up. But the other thing that comes up all the time, over and over, is that, you know, these people have no voice. You know, they we're incarcerated or we're just barely trying to get our lives back together. John and I, in a privileged situation, can become a voice for these others, for this issue. We're not speaking over anyone. And all of these people are our strongest supporters and advocates, actually.
What have you learned about the law profession through this?
That it is a Byzantine world of difficulties. And that the criminal justice system, it's not even that there are necessarily disreputable people working in it, but it's their, you know, it's their job. It's their job. The job of public prosecutors is to respond to the public's concerns about crime. Mm-hmm. It's their job to find the, you know, and therefore when they do convict people, you know, they're reticent to easily let go of this. I mean, it's a very difficult, complicated process to for the people who are working at that level to then actually convince the system over years, over decades. of what injustice has been done to this one individual. And it's just, you know, one person at a time. So it's quite overwhelming, actually, John and I are very, you know, are so admiring of the people who are working at this to try to be helpful in a way. So we feel guilty. A couple of drummers playing cool music, you know. We love doing it. It's fun to play. We've made music for ourselves that we like, that we can play well and we're good at, and it sounds good. And we have great fun doing it. And we say sometimes we almost feel guilty about working at that level. And all the lawyers, all the exonerated people say, there are enough people thumbing through the files and sitting at computer screens. What we need is the public in different guises of life to come to some awareness of this. You know, somebody's going to send a $10 check. That's very helpful, you know. So, and as we always say that, and here's the point: what we really like to do. Is not just play the show, but if we go into do a percussion department workshop for an hour or at a music school, the real point is that one can, as Herbert Brunn said to me years ago, to raise your voice in the name of something other than yourself. So in the era of websites and how to sell your product, buy me, you know, why competitively better than the next person, why my marimba technique is hotter than the next person's. I mean, okay, you have to somehow address all of that, but mm-hmm. there has to be this other soul cleansing side of the picture. And to be able to talk to music percussionists or music students about that, about how gratifying it is to do it, and about the fact that, you know, I studied with the principal percussionist of the Cleveland Orchestra, you know, was obsessed with practicing, you know, at that level, at that stage in my life, expected to do that. Took it as seriously as possible. And I don't feel I've given up anything, not one grain of that whole history of trying to perfect that stuff. I have just found, you know, a vehicle that means more than just doing, which is not to say, I want somebody to still play that stuff perfectly, but we don't need that many people.
Sure, yeah. That's a good point.
I keep doing it perfectly. But,
yeah. The last bit of follow-up with the – on the lawyer side that I was thinking of, I guess you can confirm this, is that on the defense side, they're just backed up. I mean, it's a ton of work to do to defend people who've gotten in trouble with the law, and yes. That's just a really hard job to do – anyway, but it's really hard to do it with very few resources, which a lot of them are operating under. And then on the other side, if you're on the prosecution side, if you win a case, like that's one, like you said, it's a lot of work to have done that. And two, it's done. Like that case is over, right? For them, like we're not opening this. I've done my job.
Exactly. And then too, I mean, even all of the applications these innocence projects get, of course there are incarcerated people who did actually do the crime and right. who are, you know, I mean, less who are difficult people and who are, you know, claiming they didn't and trying to get out. So they have to actually be very careful about researching every one of these applications. So in that sense. So time consuming, yeah.
I'm going to back up because I definitely want to get to a lot of the other parts of your career, but we'll just go all the way back. And Alan, where did you grow up?
Sheboygan, Wisconsin. A small enough town where in the 60s, you know, I played in rock bands, but also in polka bands. And And I was the organist at my little neighborhood church. You know, I played the piano, and then the next logical step was to sort of do that. And I mean, it's actually a true story. You know, through high school, I would have my dance band gig, and it could have been polkas, accordions, or a pickup rock group or something. And then at midnight, I'd go over to the church and look at the board to see what hymns the pastor had put up, go through those hymns for the next morning. But it was away in a small town. Again, it was playing the organ there. Then, you know, it was my show for an hour on that morning. But anyway, that's where it started.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Did you have family members in the arts?
I did not. Though my father played sousaphone in the city band, and I joined him as a member of that band. You know, so there was, and he had a nice record collection of, you know, of classical music. That's how I was introduced to it, and it was, I don't know if it was. I mean, I started piano lessons at the age of six, and they were very serious about me practicing every day. So that's how it got started.
Was that just kind of very like Mozart, kind of that kind of style? Like, was it classical style with the piano, or were you actually getting to do more pop styles?
No, it was definitely serious classical music kind of stuff. So, but yeah, what did I mean, you know, by the time I was old enough to want a drum set, and started to play. I mean, because I was sort of a serious musician and doing all of that, there were other guys in town who were the, you know, who were the real rock drummers.
Sure.
And I did gravitate more towards my understanding of jazz. You know, I had a few more records like that, and found friends that we could do a little bit more of that kind of stuff. So I also learned, you know, on the piano to play a little bit.
Gotcha.
Kind of popular styles, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What level of jazz were you talking about? Like the bop stuff, or were you doing just kind of like your standards, or all of the above?
I mean, this is the era of you know, the late bop of Miles Davis and mm-hmm. flowing into John Coltrane. And I was already attracted to the more experimental kinds of things. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. But yeah, but it was attractive in some way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. When did you start doing organ?
I guess in high school. I mean, it was sort of a, you know, because I had taken piano lessons from age 6, you know, continuously, then it was sort of a thing that was almost, it was a natural progression. And was I interested myself? Who why did I do that? I don't know. My parents encouraged it or something. But I think I saw it as, again, a small town situation where, you know, one actually becomes sort of a professional musician with your own gig.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was sort of that.
So in all of this, when does either the more serious or the more classical side, however you want to phrase it, of the percussion area start to come to you?
In Sheboygan, there was a teacher of mine, Art Schilbach was the name. And he went to school and ended up at University of Illinois in graduate school. And Art went on and was in the Dallas Symphony and then ended up in the Indianapolis Symphony. So he had a real career at that level. But when Art was in school as a graduate student, he called me one day. I still remember, you know, the telephone with the curly cord on the kitchen wall. You know, he called and he said that one of his classmates at U of I had just gotten the job in the Milwaukee Symphony. And his name was Michael Rosen. And I have to call up this guy in Milwaukee and start taking lessons. I mean, this was like an outrageous idea. Wait, Milwaukee is an hour away. Nobody in Sheboygan drives to Milwaukee for a drum lesson. And Art said, no, it's time to do this. You have to do this. And for the first months or something, my father drove me to Milwaukee, waited for my drum lessons with Michael Rosen. Finally, I could drive myself. That was obviously a life-changing situation. And so through my senior year in high school, I was driving, studying with Mike there at his house. And he's the one who said, up until then, I might have thought that I was going to go to the, I don't know, University of Wisconsin and, you know, be in a rock band or something. I don't know, you know. He said, no. And so Mike says, my classmate, Richie Wiener, just got the principal percussion in Cleveland Orchestra. He's now taken over for Cloyd Duff at Oberlin. You apply to Oberlin. I think you should try to study with Richie. I mean, I didn't know anything about anything. And I say, okay. So stumbling forward, that was how it happened.
At that time, when you're studying with Michael, how do you get gear and music at that point? Is he just like giving you some of his old stuff or is he like you have to go to the store? Kind of what you would tell a student now, I guess.
I guess, you know, I mean, there was an old percussionist drummer in Sheboygan who I never even met him. I don't remember meeting him. Somehow I was able to buy a 3-octave marimba.
Oh, wow.
and a 4-octave xylophone.
Wow, that's a what a combo.
Both wonderful instruments. You know, I mean, somehow the price of $75 comes into my ear. Maybe, but something like that.
Yeah.
So I had, I had something to practice on at home. And yeah, Michael would say, there's a book by, it's called the Goldenberg book. You got to get, go to your local music store, have them order the Goldenberg book. And Michael had himself just discovered the George Hamilton Green stuff. And he had all of this in Xerox copies. He had Xeroxed it from some old drummer in Milwaukee. So he was giving me all the time all of these Green things, which, didn't actually mean anything even to either of us. He said, wow, this is very, I never heard of this. This is interesting stuff. And then he had some ragtime stuff. He said, oh, here's a little piece. You should, it's called Log Cabin Blues. You should try to learn this, Seriously, we're, oh, yeah, okay. So we did all of this stuff. And mostly I just studied keyboard. In fact, that's all I did. I just studied marimba.
I want a little bit before we move on. I want to hear more about playing polka gigs, just because I know that's like a very Midwestern, like Northern Midwestern,
yes,
item that still happens here and there. I know.
Yes, and I saw in a very sophisticated ethnomusicology textbook, the chapter on American music there were. The polka belt, which starts in the Catskills and goes through Buffalo and Cleveland, and then across up into Milwaukee and ends in St. Paul or something. Mm-hmm. This is the polka belt.
Yeah.
So there I was in the polka belt. I mean, I had to be a little bit careful because, of course, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I played in band and I played Sousa marches and all of that. So I could kind of do that stuff. And I understood the point was not to be too particularly creative. My role was just to basically play marches behind the accordion. Why was it? I guess I was just, as a high school kid, I was quite facile, I was good. I was good. I sounded good. So these older men were amused that I was interested and willing to do it. That I
amused.
Was, I should have been playing in a rock band. So why am I doing this? I don't really know what the answer is. I think maybe that, many of these, what I remember most is a group that was Ordovox. What is that? It's some sort of electric accordion or something. I don't know. And a trumpet player and a bass player. This was a little bit more of, what did they call those? I don't know, a club date kind of, background music at a supper club sort of thing. I think I played with those people even the most of all. So it had a mixture of polka stuff. But, these are also people who had their day jobs, but, probably wished they were real musicians, so they wanted to play also their versions of jazz or standards or whatever. So I think it was more interesting to me because it was a more of a mixture of music to play.
You weren't called on to get the party going. It sounds like you could just.
Exactly. No. Okay.
Tell me about going to Oberlin. What was that experience like?
What retrospectively was the key to the whole thing was that because Richard Wiener was in Cleveland and came down to Oberlin as much as one day a week, one afternoon a week, it meant two things, that my 55 minutes with him every 10 days or a week or something like that were absolutely precious, to just precious 55 minutes. And I learned, to during the week to make lists of questions that, that I was going to ask him. I learned that he was quite young and not an experienced teacher at that time. And I learned after a while that the best thing to do was to ask him to play something for me. He might, if something didn't feel right or I didn't understand, it was better to just ask him to play it and then watch and figure it out from what is he doing that's different from what I'm doing. You know? So there was, because of that, what it meant was that all of the other time during the week, the adults in my life, who were the adults going to be? Well, it was the young people on the faculty who were the composers, because in that era, they didn't have a specific composition department at an undergrad school. They were the theory teachers, but the theory teachers were the composers and right. Young people themselves. So those were the people who I got to know, and they would, you know, I would ask them, or they would bring me, you know, that one of them showed me and said, there's a piece just a couple of years ago, the Stockhaus, that, and look at that. And we could talk about it, you know. So somehow I ordered a score of Zicklus, and, you know, it was less than, well, I don't know, it was like 10 years old at that point, the score mm-hmm. itself. Was all, yeah, and I'm fascinated. What the hell is this? It's not something I could take to Wiener, not yet anyway. So I would, you know, so anyway, these were the people who then became the mentors in my life at that time. And it was such a good balance, you know. That so Gary Kvistad was a year older than me, you know. So Gary and I had to. It was I think there were only six of us in the department. There are six students or something like that. So we spent a lot of time together exploring this stuff together, going to the composition faculty to talk about these kinds of pieces, and we also had to be responsible. Not that Wiener was irresponsible, but yet there was a certain, you know, we just had to decide, look, who's going to play the tambourine in band and who wants to play the timpani part? And, yeah. You know, let's just get this done. And it's not like there was a father figure constantly there telling you what to do and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, that can be wonderful to have that kind of mentorship. But it was perfect for Gary and I that we had to be more responsible as undergraduates already and just make sure things were happening and balance all of these different things. You know, continue to produce exactly what Wiener needed in his lessons, and I had the full expectation that that's what I was going to do, play in a symphony orchestra. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be as good as he was doing that kind of stuff. But then over those few years, you know, more and more it became clear that this other stuff was actually really fascinating, you know? So anyway, that's kind of how it went.
Were the lessons then a lot of, with Wiener, were there a lot, was it mostly just orchestral excerpts and that being the primary focus?
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
And this was before the era of four mallet marimba. And anybody today is going to say, wait a second, what the hell did you do for 4 years? Because we did not do four mallet marimba. There was no such thing. I mean, there right. was the second movement of the Creston, right?
Yeah, yeah. There were some pieces in Japan that may not have even gotten to you yet.
They have not yet arrived.
Yeah.
So we did lots of technical studies and, you know, Bach mm-hmm. and violin, you know, Saint-Saëns, Rondo and Capriccioso, whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sophisticated kind of two mallet playing and all the orchestral excerpts kind of stuff. Yeah. But this was the era when George Zell at the Cleveland Orchestra was smart enough to hire Pierre Boulez as the assistant conductor. So Boulez would come occasionally to Cleveland for the purpose of doing the repertoire that George Zell was not going to do. And yeah. Wiener would bring to my lessons and say, look at this thing. This is, you know, we're playing a piece by Messiaen, this huge orchestra. Look at this xylophone part. And he was excited about it. Isn't this great? You know, and he's showing me the xylophone parts too, you know, exotic birds and all of this stuff. which were coming to this country for the first time. And they came there. And that's the era when Boulez did the Rite of Spring with, you know, famous recordings with the Cleveland Orchestra. So there was excitement about that. And a couple of times, then they would do big pieces that needed extra percussionists. And I played a couple of times with the Cleveland Orchestra in that era. And I was terrified. I mean, you know, and I remember Wiener saying, you know, when you play in the school orchestra, everybody's at the same level as you are. Everybody's kind of doing it for the first time and nobody's sure what to do, whatever. When you play in the orchestra, and he always just called it the orchestra, mm-hmm. when you're with the orchestra, it's going to be absolutely clear that you won't have any question what to do and when to do it. It'll be perfectly clear. Don't worry about anything.
Right.
And that was the feeling, too. I mean, it was such a well-oiled machine just working perfectly that, you know, it would have been really hard not to play along.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I thought you were going with that was, and it would be very clear that you are not on the level of anybody here. Oh. That's where I thought you
were. No, so, that's interesting. But so it was very kind of him to actually express that, you know, even if he was thinking that, which was, sure. of course, true.
Oh, that's great. So, you know, all the stuff you just said about the, you know, theory and comp people at the time, that was kind of a what I've read or heard about from that time period. It was sort of an odd time, only because wasn't the expectation for people who were doing composition and theory at that time was like everything was extremely atonal, like in terms of either presentation or what their expected output was. Do I have that wrong? Because I've read things about kind of that era.
There was a slightly older man on the faculty who certainly probably felt that way. Mm-hmm. And I was not, but Gary and I wouldn't have been attracted to that professor. I've never stopped to actually figure it out about what age some of these guys that I did, but you know, they were like right out of grad school themselves, right, or right out of their doctoral studies. So they were, you know, probably in their upper 20s, and you know, they were older than me, but they were fascinated by what Cage and Crumb and Stockhausen were doing, and that's what they were showing us and propagating on the little new music festivals. I mean, we were also interested in that other sort of music, but there wasn't much for percussionists to do in that sort of stuff compared to what there was in the others.
Sure. Yeah. Is there any special realization during your undergrad where you were like, okay, I'm not, the orchestral thing is not where I'm going to go. Now what do I do? Did that happen? Or had you already kind of figured out, I have a plan for the next thing?
It did happen. And I was envious of, jealous of my classmates who were string players who had a course in string quartet.
Yeah.
They would form a quartet for each semester and really work and get coached and do that. We didn't even have percussion ensemble. It's kind of ironic that I've spent my life in percussion ensemble. And I, not only did I not have four mallets in undergrad, I didn't have percussion ensemble. What the hell did we do for 4 years? We got really good at what we did do. I did form a group already in my junior year, an improvisation group, because I didn't know how else to do it, but I wanted to play with other people. So, mm-hmm. you know, there was a guy who played synthesizer and prepared piano, and what did David Axe play? Cello and a flute player and, a little quartet of mixed instruments, and we met twice a week. And drew our own graphic scores or found graphic scores. I don't think we ever really did free improvisation, but we were just trying to play graphic music or something like that. And by my senior year, I kind of thought that that's what I wanted to do, is to form a chamber music group where I was the only percussionist and there would be a few other people. You know, the model was something, you know, like, you know, a sextet or something like that. There were such kind of groups in New York City at that time. So that's what I thought I would wish to do, actually. And I had come to realize that that would be more satisfying for me than standing in the back of an orchestra. But it was at that point that Gary, who was a year older and had left and had met Jan Williams in Buffalo, and Jan Williams had had at one point kind of a pickup group of people, himself and a couple of the guys in the Buffalo Symphony and whatever, who played percussion quartets and who had a little competition and gotten scores submitted. And there was this whole suitcase of percussion quartets, which had never been played because Jan had had this aspiration, but couldn't really make it work with in those circumstances. And Gary called me, you know, from Buffalo and said, I think he said, and we still make this joke, he said something like, hey, I've got an idea that's going to change your life.
Wow. Or
something. I mean, really, something like that. He would remember exactly what he said. You know, let's make a group. We should play these pieces. We could make a group and do this. So that's how it started. I mean, you know, immediately, yes, let's try to do this. Mm-hmm.
And that becomes Black Earth.
That becomes Black Earth.
when you form this, you kind of have either like some works that are. Available because of different people, and then you're also, are you all just like, you every rehearsal you like someone brings an idea, like here's a new thing, were you working things out and then not playing them? I'm curious how the group operated just kind of on a rehearsal level.
I think we already found enough music with the idea that, you know, I've said this many times now, especially about percussion group Cincinnati. After all of these decades, you know, there are younger groups now who just, and not whether it's percussion groups or chamber music groups, who just, you know, inhale music. They're going through so much repertoire. And they're so.
I love that word. That's a perfect word. Inhale.
And, you know, the list of all the pieces that they've premiered or commissioned is just, you know, interminable, and good for them, good for the young composers that they're helping. But basically, that's the mode to go. And we sort of did the other way, that if we found a piece, and I think it's now more clear to me why. I mean, because nobody else had ever played this music, even if it was the music of Harrison and Cage and that era, even university ensembles had not much played that music. The guys themselves had it played by boyfriends and girlfriends and dancers and other composers, and,
yeah,
you know, and must have been terrible performances of it. So,
and even if there were other performances of it, it's not like you would have found out about it probably at that time.
Exactly. There weren't recordings of it or any such thing. So,
yeah.
But the point was that when we would find a piece, I mean, we really, you know, it got into a repertoire, and, you know, maybe I was always the one who was a little bit more conscientious about building programs and what the slots of a programmed repertoire was going to be. And so, so in that sense, there would be, you know, the first year or two of those concerts, you know, we would be trying out something to go into a certain slot and mm-hmm. have a program that we could take on the road and really just play it over and over and get really comfortable with that repertoire. And that model has stuck for 40 years, that we find great pieces that we are absolutely committed to, and we want to share them, and we want to play them with the same facility that a string quartet plays a Beethoven quartet that they've known since they were a kid, you know? I think that's part what I would judge as part of our success of being recognized as a group that you want to listen to, is that actually we play the repertoire we play. It's very clear that we know what we're doing, you know. So meaning that the programs at home at Cincinnati, you know, we used to have three concerts a year, you know, that there we would always be, you know, I mean, certain pieces would recycle every 4 or 5 years at home because we'd have a new group of students and we could play it again here. But otherwise we were always asking people to write new pieces, look for new things. And we rarely, almost never would this be a case where it was a percussion composer, and certainly not a percussionist who was writing music. We were all, you know, I would hear a piece of computer music or a string quartet or a piano piece or something and think it was fabulous and say, could you now write something for percussion? And don't worry, we'll help you. Just send us the pencil sketches. We'll talk about it. We'll send you, you know, recordings, whatever. That's, we want to be involved in the development of the piece. We do not want some finale printed final, you know, gift to us. It won't be a gift.
That is hilarious. Oh my gosh.
John Luther Adams very, very kindly even writes this little story in one of his books that he's writing all these pieces for us. And he wanted to write a piece. He had to have a, you know, there was all different layers of kinds of different pieces. And he needed to have a piece that had, you know, glissando, the idea of slopes. Couldn't always be this kind of stuff. There had to be slopes in it.
Right.
So he sends us a piece for each of us with a pair of timpani, a pair of kettle drums, you know.
Yeah.
And all these glissandos and all of, you know, and, you know, 7 against 5 against 3 against this and that, and faster and slower, up and down. And, okay, we set it up. We read through it. And I wrote back to him, John, it's a piece of shit.
How'd he take that?
You know, much to his credit. I mean, because he even prints the story to this day in one of his books. Exactly. And he said he appreciated, you know, that I was honest with him, and that was very helpful for performers, not just to assume, oh, this is an important composer, you know, we'll just do what he says. because what it then engendered was, he thought of, oh, wait, what about the siren in Ionization? And then he wrote a quartet for four sirens, which is a very powerful piece. So he got all of his crossings of wave shapes and, you know, little smaller sirens which did faster loops and bigger sirens which did slower loops. And so that's a good piece. And the timpani thing, I was right. It was.
That's awesome. Oh, that's great. So I think what I enjoy hearing about this is just that you all as a group were very conscious about vetting. Like if you kind of said, if we're going to spend this time together and if we're going to spend time on this piece, it better be worth it. Right.
Absolutely. And, and to find the way to talk to composers to say, look, I understand that at the piano, or in front of your computer screen with a certain program.
Yeah.
Or even studying an orchestra score and learning how Ravel did it and then writing a violin part. You can sort of know what you're doing and why you want to do it. There is no composer on the planet who can possibly know percussion as well as a percussionist knows it. Every right. one of us throughout the world has our own collection of 1,000 instruments, our own collection of 5,000 sticks, and every one of those combinations, and no composer should ever feel the least bit diminished when a percussionist says, yes, but I think if you did this instead, or don't you really mean? Or
yes, that's it. Don't you really mean?
I've done that 100 times. I think what you really mean here, I mean, literally just they send you music, you just cross it out and play. I think what you're trying to get at is something like this. And then you do that and they, oh yeah, that's great. I mean, once in a while, people are, you know, feel like you're diminishing them in some way because they have their image that the composer is supposed to know. And I think if you can be very, very clear that it's not in any way attacking their expertise or their ideas or anything like that. It's just that they can't possibly be expected to know the minutiae of percussion the way they can know most other instruments. Yeah. So yeah. Yes, we were very clear about that all along.
That's awesome. I mean, what's kind of fun just thinking about it now is just, did you even, I would assume at the time, did you feel like this is just we're in a new terrain right now? I understand where you're pulling from when you're thinking of like string quartets, chamber things and stuff, but you also have to be like, this is literally like, this really is new. Did it feel that way? Was it like invigorating to think in that sense?
It's a good question. It's an obvious question. And I'm not sure that I don't know how to answer it. I wish maybe I should think about it. I don't know if I'll ever be able to get back to what I was thinking, whether in some ways, you know, as a young person in your 20s and 30s, I had a very high opinion of myself and what I was doing, sure. I'm sure.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I don't know, though. I mean, now one of the things that I always say is that that the joke was on me, in a sense, that I was already an anachronism, because this was exactly at the time where, you know, like the guys in Nexus the whole world music thing had just then come on the scene. I mean, when I was in school, there wasn't an ethnomusicology professor. There was right. not, you know, I mean, I think there were some LPs in the library of field recordings from other cultures. Just at the time when percussionists of my generation were appropriately blown away and completely excited about studying tabla or African drums or gamelan or whatever. I mean, that on the one hand, this sort of whole discovery of the history of ragtime xylophone and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, Mike Rosen and I had been doing in Wisconsin before that, and, you know, not having the foresight, hey, we could actually make something. You know? I mean, I played a bunch of George Hamilton Green on my senior recital with a pianist just because I thought it was fun and it was interesting and challenging and all of that. And okay, so there was that. And oh, and the whole, you know, for Mallet thing, I was sort of just starting that. Anyway, my point is the anachronism of me wanting to take this model of the string quartet. Mm-hmm. And necessarily it even had to be a string quartet which played, you know, not just, you know, Mozart and Debussy, but, you know, probably played Schoenberg and Webern, and then commissioned and played Ligeti or Lutosławski, or, you know, string quartets that did late Beethoven, but also were involved in, I mean, this was my model. This is what we need a percussion group to do. Well, what a joke. That was like completely anachronistic. We were past that by that moment. I don't know. So that's what the group always has been, though, wanting to be that kind of string quartet, which is not to say that we haven't always played music by composers who were influenced by musics of other cultures and all of that, but we didn't really, that was just not going to be our thing, you know, to do that kind of stuff.
So how does both formation of Percussion Group Cincinnati and teaching at the college, how do those kind of come into play here?
The Black Earth Group got this position at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb as the second position. So there was the first position, and their department got big enough that it was realized that they could use a second teacher. And the first teacher, Al O'Connor, had the idea that there were these guys down in Urbana. We were just hanging out. I'm sorry, we gave us a room to hang out and do our Black Earth thing, which was you know, an amazing, fortuitous thing that we did not go to a farm in Black Earth, Wisconsin, and convert the barn, which was the ludicrous first idea. So we took this job in DeKalb, but there were four of us taking one position. One secondary position and dividing that salary between the four of us. But I mean, it was a salary. We had nothing before that. I mean, it meant that we were literally on food stamps in the summer. We had to take the pay just for 9 months and assume we wouldn't die in the summer. You know, we were members of the local food co-op, and we used the Black Earth truck to go around to the local Illinois farms to pick up the honey and the flour and bring it back to that was our contribution to the co-op. We played a concert at the University of Cincinnati on their new music series.
And what year approximately are we talking about right now?
That would be 1976. In 1976, we played on a new music series. And in 76, the conservatory here, which is a very high level place, still had a guy from the symphony, an older guy from the symphony, coming over one afternoon a week. So this music school, of all music schools, was a bit out of date with that kind of thing. And there were some composers on the faculty and the orchestra conductor who were aware that this was now not quite right. So we were invited, we played this concert, but it was the resident string quartet, the LaSalle String Quartet, a very famous, you know, European emigres who had a huge career, were in residence here. And they were the ones, I got a call from the first violinist of the LaSalle Quartet saying, we have an idea, we think your group should come here in the same kind of position as the LaSalle Quartet has, and you develop a program like this. And I mean, even now, just to repeat the story, right? that was a pretty significant moment coming from a very authoritative voice. So that's how the Black Earth Group moved from a much lesser position. Well, by then we were in a better, well, but we were still kind of, as a group, the second position. We were not running the department there, which was good for us. You know, it was good for young people not to have all those responsibilities and have plenty of time to go on tour and divide up half of the student body between the three or four of us. It was great because we were free to go and we could leave for a month if we needed to. All of that stuff. We did European tours every year and we'd be gone literally for a month to do that. So when we came here, it became suddenly much more serious. We were the department, you know, we each now had our own salary, but we had to do everything. We were the department. And it meant having displaced the symphony guy who had been here for decades, and the current students who liked him, were here for him, were much embittered and much against us when we showed up. So it was a very distasteful situation. That guy was bitter about it. He embittered all of his students, and suddenly we had a much bigger, more demanding job. I was the one who said, I still want to do this. I think we can do this. It's going to be a tough year or two, but eventually the students will come because of us. They'll come to study with us. We'll get it worked out, how to run the department, buy the stuff. It'll work, and then we can get back to a more fluid, da-da-da. But that by that time, Gary especially said, you know, I mean, he just wanted to move on. He said this is a choice in his life. He could move on. So that was a very, very difficult moment. We had been classmates at Oberlin as undergraduates and done this whole thing together for those 6 or 7 years. It took a few years to get over that, actually, between us. That was a real painful divorce. And, you know, and I mean, after a while, you know, now it's very, very close again. But so I went to the dean then and said, here's what's happening. The group is disbanding, falling apart. And the dean was also very, very kind. And he said, you know, if you just want to run the department yourself, I mean, we did that experiment. It was interesting. You know, why don't you just become the drum teacher here and have a solo career, do what you want. And I said, I don't feel like I'm finished with this idea yet. You know, I would like to look for other people to do this. And he said, oh, okay, good luck. But he said he would support it, you know, if I could find 2 other people to do this. So Jim Cully has been here since then. Jim Cully was just coming out of grad school. And actually, he was the first person I was interested in. And the dean said, okay, but if you're going to take somebody who's just coming out of grad school, the other person has to be somebody with real experience. I can't have you just, you know, I can't put on my faculty to grad students, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's how I found Bill Uhas, who was willing to move from his position at Ithaca. So someone who had real teaching experience and had been at Illinois before I was there. So he knew Herbert Brunn and, you know, and was all, you know, in the mindset of this kind of music anyway. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
And we'll get to part 2 with Alan Oddy next week, which you will not want to miss. So stay tuned. As promised, this week's rave is Ireland, specifically the St. Patrick's Day parades we participated in. Kudos, first off, goes to the director of athletic bands at Mizzou, Dr. Amy Knops. She really pushed for us to continue to do this trip, as previous directors had done every 4 years or so prior to our arrival, and she specifically wanted us to not only perform in the main parade in Dublin on March 17th, but, as many groups do going out there, perform in another town while in the country. For us, this would be the small town of Tipperary. Turns out that the song, It's a Long Way to Tipperary, which a quick search says was written in 1912, is the same tune for one part of Mizzou's fight songs called Every True Son. Why not perform that, along with many of our other selections, there in their town's major parade? They accommodated us by moving their parade one day earlier and having us as the featured group there doing our set in the main town square. And they greeted us with happiness and their blend of Irish weather, rain, and wind. As I told the Irish folks we interacted with who appreciated us coming, we would have been upset if we didn't perform in rain and wind at some point in their country. For myself, and I believe for many of the other folks on the trip, the main event, the Dublin St. Patrick's Day Parade, was the best experience of the trip and maybe the best parade experience I've ever had. It begins with the fact that the parade starts at noon local time, which is amazing. The weather was as good as possible, in the upper 50s and partly sunny. The crowds were packed and excited for all. Folks high-fived us throughout. The parade moved at a slow, comfortable pace, and it honestly felt great to be there and see much of the city in that fashion. And most importantly, the Marching Mizzou students were tremendous then and throughout the week. All were very well behaved and really represented the school well. It was a pleasure getting to do this trip, and I hope we're able to go back again at some point. In Ireland, we saw a few other sites there as well, including the city of Galway, the cliffs of Moher, and other parts of Dublin. And we were there and quickly back again to school. It was just that fast. So again, this is a rave for Ireland, their people, and their parades. If you can, it is strongly recommended to go and enjoy it all. They'll be happy to have you. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can hear every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. You can also find the show on SoundCloud and Spotify and many other podcast catchers of your choice. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and X at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next time for part 2 with Alan Oddie. Until then.